Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Greg Haas has forged a career in Midwestern politics, policy, campaigning, crisis communications, and media. Now he's a novelist. His new book, The Butcher's Thumb, is about a sort of alternate universe, of the Bush administration before, during, and after the Scooter Libby Valerie Plame scandal. We're invited him to talk about the book and politics as the season starts its slow midsummer boil. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Hey, thank you very much for being here, Ian.
What do you mean by the butcher's thumb?
Well, I think that one of the main concepts that I wanted to get through in the book, people oftentimes think that in campaigns or in politics, you can massively change the course of public opinion or events, when in reality, all you can do is kind of tip the scales a little bit. So I use the analogy of the butcher, you know, the old analogy of the butcher who put his thumb on the scale to get a few extra pennies for the meat he was selling. And the idea is that you can tip the scales a little bit. You can't outright, you know, change the reality. As great as some of the best political manipulators of all time, I think Karl Rove's probably one of those. Those folks, they can only alter things by bits and pieces. And I think it's, you know, so it's something that I wanted to illustrate in the book and obviously start right away with the title.
The distinction, though, is with the butcher's thumb, is the butcher's actually cheating.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. So
right.
You, even if you're not cheating, you can only change things so much.
Exactly.
If you're cheating, how does that differ morally?
Well, I guess that, yeah, there's two things. I mean, the point in the analogy, obviously, yeah, is he's always cheating, and maybe in some ways you're cheating reality or cheating destiny by altering things a little bit, by bits and pieces. But then there's also the idea of stolen elections and things that have been talked about in the past. And one of the things I think is very important for people to understand is something that I believe is that elections cannot be massively stolen. You can't change the, you know, no matter how good somebody is, there's only a range in which they can alter the outcome in any election. And I think so. If you assume worst possible case and then the 2004 elections were somehow stolen, you know, the other kind of competitive events, things that were going on, had far more outcome, far more to do with the outcome than probably anything that had to do with actual outright cheating.
Right. As far as outright cheating goes, it's not worth it. Until you
exactly.
get to that margin
exactly.
of success where there's – because you can only move things so far.
Right.
So you have to be close enough to
right,
make it matter.
Right. And you know, are you going to risk everything? Are you going to risk kind of the ultimate public humiliation, you know, to move things, you know, a tenth of percent, two-tenths of a percent when you would have won anyhow? You know, so there's kind of, you know, that's all kind of built into the book and part of the idea that, you know, you make the decisions you make based upon, you know, the outcomes, the risk. And that's part of the, you know, getting into how do you analyze that? How do you come to that conclusion if you're going to do that? The last little thing, too, that I wanted to illustrate is I imagined if people were sitting around a room and they were talking about what they might do. You know, one of the chief things that they would talk about is the security of systems. You know, there's this debate about electronic systems and all the different types of systems, but some of them there's very little discussion about is how secure. Because I don't care what kind of system it is, if people can get into the room the night before and the night after, they can alter anything. I mean, whether there's a paper trail or not doesn't matter. And, you know, across Ohio, we have a lot of boards of elections right now whose machines are incredibly vulnerable. And so that, you know, those are things I wanted to raise. But again, you know, one of the points in the book is I don't make the allegation that they actually do cheat. You know, I just talk about how they might if they
were
discussing.
There's circumstantial. You don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's the imagery for me with the butcher's thumb is that the butcher's doing this while everyone's standing there watching him.
Right.
So it's all done with not tacit approval, but a willingness to
deny, a
sense of denial on the part of the observers, the people, the customers, and this place, the voters.
You know, and I think the reality is that we're in denial about a lot of things in politics. I mean, you know, the idea that 70% of the American people thought that Iraq was behind 9/11, that didn't happen by accident. And yet, in terms of how we look at that, we're all – even some people of my political bias are somewhat in denial about how that happened and how that many people could be misled and misinformed. And so, you know, that's something that I wanted to take a look at behind the scenes as well.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. And my guest is Greg Haas, author of The Butcher's Thumb, a new political thriller. Greg is well known for his work in Midwestern politics, policy campaigning, crisis communications, and all of that. Now he's a novelist, and we're talking about that book and how it relates to modern politics today. I mentioned earlier it's sort of an alternate universe of the Bush administration. How did you decide what to keep and what to throw away?
You know, it's like you get started on something like this and you follow the story. I mean, for me, this was a very bizarre experience. And sometimes, you know, I've talked at a couple of writing conferences about it to other folks. There was a point where I actually thought I might have to go in for some serious therapy because these characters were becoming far too real to me.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Who does it remind you of? Yeah, it was a little bit scary. And then suddenly I'd be like talking about this character and I would see a huge chunk of myself in him that I didn't even realize I was putting in. And realize, oh my gosh, you know, that's me, you know, or that's something that I thought about or I did or and you find it in absolutely every single character that you write about in the book, but also the storyline. You know, I mean, it changed dramatically. The protagonist was a minor character in my original outline, and basically, one day, he's sitting at the table next to me saying, "This is my story." And you know, I have to say, I initially got into this wanting to write this parallel universe of really the 2000, 2004, and 2008 elections. And yet, really, I think the book in the end became this guy's redemption, and maybe hopefully some way it's a little bit of my own, you know, in all of it, that this was about a person who was obviously deeply flawed and somewhat misguided about why they were doing what they were doing, but ultimately kind of, you know, with the help of the right people, found their way. And so, you know, in the end, the book became about the protagonist and a much different story than I imagined.
Who was the protagonist? What was
– The protagonist is a fellow by the name of Matt Risen,
right,
who is from Marion, Ohio, and went to Stanton Military Academy, which are both John Dean characteristics. And so he became kind of my imagination of what if there had been a John Dean inside an administration similar to the Bush administration. But I always have to stress that these, you know, it is fiction, and you take bits and pieces of truth and then outright fiction, and so there's this story of this guy that is in events that are similar to ones we know, with characters that are similar but also very different, and how he struggles to ultimately make peace with himself.
He made me think of Scott McClellan.
Yeah,
you know, I went back and was reading some articles about how the Bush administration reacted when Scott, who was a press secretary, resigned, and how then he, you know, of course, he later went on and wrote a book about it, which was fascinating, reading about the Bush administration. But it was interesting to see the Bush. They didn't actually call him crazy, but
they said he's
just not the guy we used to know.
You know, here's the strangest part of that story, though. And for me, the reason I don't immediately identify with Scott McClellan is that I wrote this character, and I've been working on the book for 5 years, and started really right after the 2004 elections. So this protagonist emerges, and this whole storyline emerges with him long before the Scott McClellan thing broke. So
because that was only 4 years ago.
Yeah,
years ago. Yeah, 2007. Yeah. So it's funny how things happen.
Yeah,
how they unravel. 614-292-8513. If you would like to speak with Greg Haas, author of The Butcher's Thumb, you might recognize the name Greg. He is well known in the Midwest for his work in politics, policy campaigning, and so forth for the basically for Democratic candidates and issues. It's your background in media and managing media communications for campaigns really comes out in this. It was very interesting. If you're even the littlest bit of political junkie when it comes to Midwestern politics, it's a very interesting book because you're reading about yourself a little bit.
Yeah, there's hopefully a lot of Ohio in here. You know, I'm constantly amazed at, you know, there's a great, incredible history with Ohio as being a melting pot. And people lots of times only think of it in terms of, you know, kind of post-European immigration. But when you think back, you know, one of the things that I always picked up from Alan Eckert's work in Frontiersman and mm-hmm. Sorrow in the Heart and Dark and Bloody River and those great books is Ohio was a melting pot 1,000 years ago, 800 years ago. Even before Europeans came here, you know, it was a melting pot. And if you think about the geography of the land and what creates that, it becomes kind of obvious after you think about it for a while that, you know, the Appalachians just stop here and the Great Lake region's southernmost point is here. And you begin kind of what's like the Great Plains or similar, you know, in terms of the western part of the state. So it's like a place where things come together. But since 1830, we've been a balancing point in presidential elections. We've states come and go in terms of whether they're a battleground state. Florida's been a solid Democratic state, a solid Republican state, and now is a little bit of a battleground state. Virginia's now a little bit of a battleground state, but it comes and goes. Wisconsin and Minnesota are kind of drifting away from battleground states. California was, at one point a battleground state. Now it's pretty solidly Democrat. You've got all these states that kind of come, go. Ohio, every single presidential election is within the range, even when we've got our favorite sons on the ballot. I think that's going to continue. I think it's
a function of its history, not a function of its future, but a function of where it's
exactly,
been.
Exactly.
We have time for just one quick call before we take a break. Peg, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. I just want to – it's Peg.
Hi.
When and where are you going to have book signings? I've got two copies. I've read the book, but I've got to get them signed for the kids.
Oh, Peg. It's great to hear from you. I knew that voice. You wouldn't have had to mention your name. I don't have anything scheduled yet in terms of book signings. We're going through that kind of period where, you know, the publisher and we're trying to kind of promote the book online at this point and then hopefully see, you know, kind of which bookstores pick it up. But I will, towards the end of August, have some kind of book signing that I hope is kind of bring your book kind of book signing. And I'll be glad to let you know as soon as I know.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Peg. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much.
That is Greg Haas. He has written a book. It's called The Butcher's Thumb. If you want to hear more about that book and more about Midwestern politics with Greg Haas, stay tuned to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher this afternoon. You can see the new lineup of public affairs programming on Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group, and at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
It's 79 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. A slight chance of rain today, otherwise partly cloudy skies and a high of 87. A slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 70 degrees, and rain is likely for Tuesday. All Sides continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Greg Haas, political consultant, media consultant, and now author of the book of a novel called The Butcher's Thumb. It is a political thriller, and talks about politics in its shades of slime, I think is how I put it at the top. I think you said, you aren't the first writer to paint American politics and political media in shades of slime, but as a seasoned political and media consultant, you lend a certain authenticity to the story. And I was wondering, because the book is – the story is told largely from the point of view of what –
A Republican press secretary.
Yeah. But of course, you come from the other side of the coin, and I'm wondering if you were tempted to, tell more about the reaction from the other side and why you didn't.
Well, you know, if I'd written a nonfiction book, obviously that would have been the perspective. But I, you know, as I mentioned, you know, I've talked about this a few times. I've spent the bulk of my life observing, you know, the Lee Atwaters, the Karl Roves, and studying them far more than I've observed anybody on my side, and far more than I've observed their behavior. And, you know, it's like when you break it down, whether, you know, any presidential administration I've been on the sidelines of or support of, kind of when my party's in power, I don't pay as much attention to the people as to the policies. You know, it's like you get engaged in healthcare reform or issues that you care about, and you're kind of in the battle about those. Whereas when the other administration's in power, you spend your time really watching the people and studying why they're doing what they're doing and anticipating where they're going to go and that kind of stuff. So so to me, in some ways, it was very natural kind of. The second thing is that the last 8 years, from a political standpoint, have been, I mean, just crudely, some of the most fascinating in our history. I mean, you could not have written the script. If I invented the 2000 election kind of as a script, nobody would have believed the book. I mean, I played off of real things that allowed you much more freedom than probably anybody's had to talk about in terms of politics before it happened. So that was the first thing. The second thing is, I think, you know, I hate to use this word, but almost an admiration in some respect for the Karl Roves and the people like them and the Lee Atwaters from spending your life doing this. They were very, very good at what they did or are. And I was kind of thinking of Lee Atwaters. I was saying that because I heard a seminar that he put on one time that was actually the best hour and a half I ever spent learning about politics. I think that these guys the real characters were interesting. I try to, you know, I mean, I think that the characters in the book, part of the game of the Ramana Clay thing is that you kind of play along with people feeling like, well, this is a repeat of history, and then boom, you go off on a very different course. And with the characters, you know, hopefully, you know, throughout the book, they're thinking, okay, well, this is very Dick Cheney-like or whatever, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's, you know, clearly not. And so I was – you know, one of my favorite books of all time was All the King's Men, and I loved the way that kind of went in and out of the life of Huey Long, and so I wrote this as kind of a model, you know, hopefully, you know, inspired by that at least.
You said earlier that you spent 5 years writing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to you about it, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 years ago in a parking lot after Columbus on the Record,
and
we were talking, and I said, I think I told you, you know, you look great. You seem like you're doing really, really well. And you said, well, I'm writing a book.
Yeah, it was cathartic. It was from a vocation standpoint I've never really had a hobby. I was obsessed with work and family. I hope I always kept a good balance on those things. But, you know, friends, family, and work were kind of my whole life. And I didn't really spend a lot of time developing any hobbies. And so, you know, as I started to write this, one day it just hit me, this is my boat in a bottle. It's like it may never get beyond my desk, but, you know, it's something my son can have and show his kids, like what his crazy dad did, you know. So I found out what a lot of people know about, you know, hobbies are really a nice thing to have. So it became cathartic in that sense. And then as I started to learn the characters and learn about them, I would pick up bits and pieces and say, that's me. And I literally, with all the major characters in the book, found something that I didn't realize about myself or it was not a front of mind kind of thing. It was that was very helpful, so it was just a fantastic experience, a great learning experience, and something that for everybody out there who has any inclination to do it because it's the time of your life. It's a great, great ride.
You are critical of the media. No surprise. I mean, most people are. right up there with lawyers. You're critical of the media, I think, for the political mastermind in the book.
Yeah. From different perspectives. Yeah.
Stephen Shay, I think, is his name.
Yeah.
He says the media fell into three categories, friends, enemies, and eunuchs.
Yeah.
So is that you?
No.
Speaking?
No. And I'm not just saying that because you're hearing
it. Is that Greg in Stephen Shay's?
No, that was my observation of a lot of people in politics and their views. But to me, and obviously in the book, the media is the salvation, ultimately. The media is the one place that the guy can go for help. And it's the battle within the media, and it's no accident this guy's a press secretary. And so, you know, the media plays a very major role in the book, the way in which he's kind of, the threat of him is removed is to portray him as kind of crazy and in the media and in effect the media, and how he can figure out a way to get a step ahead of them is to how he works with the media in the end. And the observations of that, you know, he even gets kind of grudging credit from his opponents as he's doing it. And so, you know, to me, and this is always the case, I've never fallen into the, you know, I don't believe the blame the media category. Mm-hmm. But I do fall into the category of, in the end, it's all about the media. You know, it's about whether, you can have. You can get your case through. And so it's about you. It's about, you know, and it's about your abilities to tip the scales or about your ability to, but also in terms of the way the media covers it. You and I have talked in the past, actually, you know, about the fact that the media today is much more handcuffed by, you know, it's not like we, you know, in the height of the McCarthy hearings where one guy could go on the air and change the opinions and the focus of the entire country, you know, with a simple statement. And so, today it's so diluted and so watered down that it becomes much more about kind of the manipulators and much more about how it's played. But like our reality today, the media is the salvation. I mean, it's the way in which, you know, we'll either climb out of this mess or forever stay in it. I think, hopefully I portrayed in the book not a different opinions about the media through different characters. But I think, you know, I mean, the protagonist falls in love with a
lefty.
Yeah, lefty
photographer.
Journalist.
<You're right. laughs>
on balance, it's probably a very kind of actually media friendly book in some ways. Even though some of the characters aren't.
Well, that's the case all the way around. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Or you can go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if you have a question for Greg Haas, author of The Butcher's Thumb. It's a political thriller. It's just out now. And I think you can get it online, right, Greg?
Yep. Amazon, barnesandnoble.com.
Okay. All right. And you can read about it online as well, or you can hear about it now, and you can talk to Greg personally. Matt Risen, the protagonist in the book, the press secretary for the Bush-like president and at first presidential candidate, is offended when someone calls him a careerist.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
think it was the woman he eventually fell
yeah.
in love with. But
yeah. Yeah.
that was her kind of a flippant remark that she made or she aimed at him, and it bothered him.
Yeah. 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 I think that when people who are caught up in any of the careers that are so consuming, you know, that are all consuming, and as you're, you know, fighting to move up, you know, within any administration, there's a defensiveness about the priority you've put on your career, you know, and the fact that you've made it everything. And it's kind of like, you know, walking up to somebody who's been at the bar every single night having too many drinks and telling them they're an alcoholic. You know, it's a little bit of the same thing. To, you know, the reaction is going to be very, very defensive, and so, you know, it was kind of a way to kind of illustrate that he had different values, didn't want to live his life through his career, but was clearly doing that.
Yeah, it is a double-edged sword, particularly in politics. You know, the higher up you get, the more prestigious your wins are and that sort of thing. That's how you get ahead.
Right, right. I mean, it is. I mean, it's something, you know. And it's
not about because you're a good guy.
Right, right. I know. And that's, you know, I mean, there have been a couple of times where personally my career has kind of taken that path. I've never actually followed it for that long. You know, I've gotten too homesick too fast and too much of just an Ohio guy to live, you know, my life in D.C. And I think the longest I've ever stayed there in a job is like 6 months. You know, I've tried it a couple of times and come back because of that. I mean, you're surrounded by people who are absolutely living their job. And I just personally, I that's a flaw in the system, because I think part of why people become as jaded as they are, and part of the reason that we're kind of making some of the mistakes we're making, is because, you know, we got people who aren't probably living the healthiest lives in a lot of the most critical spots. I don't know what the solution is, only to observe it.
Alcohol consumption is, what do you say? What's the word? Prodigious?
Yeah.
It is extreme. It's much more than, I guess, just covering politics as a reporter, there were certain drinkers. But by the time I got into the business 20 years ago, you really couldn't indulge yourself that much because you're on the road a lot and you can hang out to a certain degree.
Right.
But you still have to write the story and file the story. And
right.
That's after everybody else is, you know, down at the bar.
It's not like it was when I first got involved, because when I first got involved, it was still the reporter who kept flask in his desk.
I hung out. I knew those people.
Yeah.
But it's even worse now, I think. But the drinking, is that part of the – and it's like nobody ever does anything. I guess you're right. It's all about the politics. It's all about the job. It's not about hobbies. It's not about what you do to get away.
Right.
It's about surviving to the next day.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's about kind of, you know, kind of putting it all away and wrapping the day up, you know.
In a bottle.
Yeah. And I've certainly made that mistake in my life and paid for the consequences of it in many ways. And I think that's obviously something I wanted to touch on. Obviously, my protagonist struggles with alcohol as he's floundering, but as he begins to find himself, the bottle gets put away. It's not something that I deal with head on in the book, or I guess it's
there's no moralizing about
right, it. Right. Yeah, yeah. It's just kind of like how he's finding his bearings. And that's one of the things that he moves out of his life. So I think it's a little bit, you know, I mean, and obviously that's something that.
Well, given his battles with that, it made me curious about Stephen Shea, his mentor,
right.
You know, the evil scientist, political operative,
right.
That he's like pickled.
Right.
And it made me wonder about why is he burying himself? If he doesn't feel guilt, he doesn't feel remorse, he doesn't feel any of that stuff that the protagonist does. But he's always drinking.
Yeah. There's something about – I mean, you know, actually a lot of – I've always been a Sherlock Holmes fan. And so there was a lot in the physical description that I wanted to kind of play off of kind of a Sherlock Holmes type character. That, you know, I mean, here was a guy that was brilliant and, you know, but the character obviously, you know, had his drug habit and different problems. And there's something about kind of, you know, the temptation of the incredibly bright to fall down in different ways. I think that you know, he just had gigantic voids he had to fill in different ways, and some of them were very secretive and some of them were very public. And I think it was, part of it is about, you know, the fact that we need to fill the voids in our lives. And if we don't do it consciously, we're going to do it subconsciously. I think, you know, his drinking was just something that was a subconscious kind of, you know, you've got these gigantic voids in your life. You got to fill them somehow. And you know, he just was going through the paces.
Politics is made up of a series of voids, it seems like. If you know that if you get pushed out of your job and what you're doing, there's always somebody there waiting to fill it.
Absolutely. That's part of the careerist, complex, you know, is the fact that they're breathing down your back. There's points in the book where I actually talk about how, you know, there's a degree of that I've observed in the careerist mentality of actually keeping kind of secondary role players beneath you so that they don't become a threat. And so there's some references to that in the book where people kind of keep their lieutenants, you know, and their second folks in line that are, you know, people that they know can never take their spot, or at least will have great difficulty taking their spot. And all of that competitiveness, you know, that race that you're surrounded by is a lot of the, you know, one of the points of the book.
Yeah, and yeah, it's American politics.
Yeah.
At its best.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is the worst most people can imagine.
Yeah.
Did you ever get kind of, well, I don't know.
yeah. Well, I wrote a book when I got really, I don't know. When I got to that I don't know stage, I sat down and wrote a book.
Actually, you know, just to interrupt you for just a second, it reminded me of something someone wrote, or someone in the previous hour mentioned this. They said, to tell the truth, you have to write fiction.
Yeah.
And it made me think of you.
Yeah. No, I really felt like I could wander in, you know, you can't touch the gray areas in nonfiction. You know, you've got to just, you know, you've got to like, or at least all you can do is kind of just say, okay, here's this gray area. But in fiction, you can wade completely into it. And yeah, they're your assumptions, you know, but people know it's fiction when they start to read it. And there are, you know, your biases and your beliefs, but you can go into a whole area that you can't go into in nonfiction. You know, you can go into the minds of voters in a way that, you know, if I said, you know, here's this Lynn Curtin from, you know, Van Wert County, you know, and here's what she says she does or what she thinks, you know, the reality that you know, she's the level of isolationist that she is, she has a lot of those views, you really have to go into her character to articulate. And so, you know, the idea of the book was to pick these people out throughout the story and kind of, you know, go inside their head. And, you know, to go back and tie things, you know, very seldom does the book leave the point of view of the protagonist. But one of the scenes is kind of a race between these two women that are part of Matt's life in different ways. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the careerist kind of competition thing. You know, there's these people – I had kind of in my mind kind of a Nixon-Kennedy thing with these two. It's like there's these people who can kind of glide through life and they seem to be able to stay a step of everybody, and they seem to just live a different way. And then there are the people who have to fight for every inch, you know, and claw to move ahead. And you know, in the rawest terms, those views do shape behaviors quite a bit, and how free you can kind of be to do what you believe in and kind of keep your moral compass. And the others where you're kind of, you know, fighting to edge ahead, you know, that complete focus on the next move, on how you're going to get by the next person. You know, it's kind of it's, you know, Nixon, Kennedy, or Johnny Bench, Pete Rose. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, there are people who have the ability to just move through life, and I think it affects their decisions a lot better. And so, you know, they're you know, there's so many levels to a book, and it's, you know,
well, not all good books, but usually good books.
Well, hopefully there's a lot to this.
There's a lot of levels to it. One of the levels I want to talk about when we return is the focus groups, because you dealt with that just a little bit a few minutes ago. And that was probably some of my favorite parts of the book, were the focus groups. So
totally fictional.
Yeah. We can talk about those when we get back. In the meantime, if you would like to speak with Greg Haas, you can call us at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Greg is the author of The Butcher's Thumb. It's a new political thriller out, and you might recognize Greg's name. He is also a longtime political consultant, media consultant, has worked around the country, but knows best the Midwest. He's an Ohio boy. So if you want to talk about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, Taming the Sea. Almost half of the fish we eat has been raised on farms, and genetic modification of fish is increasing. We'll talk to Paul Greenberg, author of Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Join us.
That discussion and much more on Fresh Air, it begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. It's 79 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly cloudy skies, a high of 87, a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 70 degrees, a good chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm for Tuesday, and a high of 86. And looking ahead to Wednesday, a chance of rain for Wednesday as well, and a high of 87.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Greg Haas, author of The Butcher's Thumb. If you'd like to speak to him, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have an email now from a listener. Observation. I have read the book by Mark Bowen entitled Censoring Science, Inside the Political Attack on Dr. James Hansen and the Truth of Global Warming. It is scary to think about the extent to which the Bush administration appointees, led by Vice President Cheney, censored the science-based findings of government-sponsored research about the growing threat of global warming and climate change. Does this observation relate to the guest's novel and experience?
Yeah, very much so. And I think it's the type of thing there are a number of books that have addressed a number of issues, not just with this administration, but the way in which the media and people are manipulated around a story and the way in which things are developed. For instance, in the book, one of the ways I wanted to illustrate this was how you built support for a war, you know, and how you got people on board in the same way that you would, you know, build support for or undermine the science behind global warming. You know, I think that what hopefully I was able to do through fiction was talk a little bit more about technique and that kind of thing than you could in nonfiction. But I do have to say also that more than anything, this is a story about characters. I mean, about people, about a you know, it's a you know, primarily it's a story of this guy's redemption from being inside this whole world. But I think anything where we're talking about, you know, I guess one of the things that the book talks about, the first line and the last line of the book are the same. The campaign never ends. And I think that's I did that for a reason. And you know, to illustrate that point. And so, you know, there's a sense by many people that you know, once Obama got elected, their job was done and everything had been accomplished that could be accomplished and we'll move on to the rest of our lives. When people, you know, have to realize that there are forces out there that are working every day to shape opinion, to shape beliefs, to shape policy, and there's just no end to it. I mean, you know, it's part of our lives, and we have to, you know, we have to try and stay up to the best we can. We have to try and make our voices heard as best we can. But it's something that you know, the forces of all this are not going to stop.
The role of military contractors. Mm-hmm. In the story is subtle, but it's key. It's mm-hmm. just exactly what you were talking about. They're right. always working right. at getting the next contract.
Right.
And today, the Washington Post yeah. rolled out a series on military contractors, among other things, especially those involved in intelligence gathering. I didn't get into it very much this morning. I didn't have time. But the issue, no matter what, I'll be fascinated to see. I would love to see the numbers on public opinion in a week after this series is over with, assuming it's over within a week, because these kind of things don't seem to stir people up when you talk about it,
right?
When you write about it.
Yeah. The tobacco, gun manufacturers, the whole military industrial complex, that people as diverse as President Washington and President Eisenhower and President Kennedy and, have warned us about, for some reason doesn't register with folks. And so, again, this is one of the things indirectly I wanted to get to in the book, is this idea that there are multiple factors and multiple influences here. But one thing that's clear is that, this country has always had, from the very beginning, this expansionist kind of segment of our philosophy and the isolationist, segment. And Ohio, again, because it's next to lakes and rivers, but it's also next to all this farmland, is balanced and very much divided between that expansionist kind of mentality of trade and focusing on trade and more of the homegrown farm, kind of deep-rooted philosophy that oftentimes leads to more of an isolationist mm-hmm. view. And so the way in which the military-industrial complex plays into this is that they've capitalized under many forms, many arguments, many diverse kind of approaches, and the neocon movement is just one more development in that history. But from the beginning of our history on, wars have been created and supported and built upon a very similar set of circumstance. There's always an outside force that causes it. There's always some kind of effort to suppress the isolationist, to kind of separate them from expressing themselves to any great degree. So it's a very big issue and one that could have taken over the book. And I kind of make the point about the role it plays in the decision making, and that the fact that a lot of the neocons and a lot of the folks are really representing people who make money off of war, and that's a great deal of what the battle in Washington is all about. The war profiteering, gun manufacturing. I mean, the simple truth is the role that gun manufacturers play in the NRA behind the scenes and in terms of creating this image that the fight is all about protecting your gun, when really it's about protecting people who are making billions and billions of dollars off of manufacturing guns. Those are things that just for some reason don't move to front of mind. And so to be able to allude to them in fiction is one way of hopefully kind of calling out and in the dark and saying, people, please, look at this because it matters.
614-292-8513. And John, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Hi, Greg. John Snyder calling.
Hi, John.
Greg, I'm interested in the local politics aspect of your book. I haven't bought it yet, but I will, I promise. The All Politics is Local theme.
Yeah.
Do you delve into the deals that are made, who's going to run, who gets support, who doesn't get support, why? Kind of the backdoor thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Eventually can lead people from a local office to a county office, to perhaps a state, or even a federal office.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, John, thanks for that question because, first of all, I think there are different, ways in which the All Politics is Local theme does come out in the book. And I talk about, but also, and I think you kind of alluded to it, kind of the a little bit of kind of maybe the darker side of politics about enablers on both sides and how sometimes the best candidate gets overlooked or demonized and how that happens so it's I can't say that there are actually local references in the book, and I talked a little bit about Columbus and its role in kind of the middle of the melting pot. And the characters from Marion but went to Ohio State, you write about what you know. So there's definitely local aspects of the book. But it's in terms of kind of the decision making of candidates or that kind of thing, probably not as much. But in terms of the bigger themes of what you were alluding to, I think quite a bit.
Thanks, Greg.
No problem, John.
Thanks
for
the call, Jen. You do mention Ohio and Columbus actually quite a bit.
Yeah.
You get a little tour of Columbus early on in the book. And it's interesting and fun to read that if you're familiar with Columbus.
Yeah.
And his sense, the protagonist's sense of familiarity with this town that he grew up in is, in terms of college,
right,
was important to him.
Right. It was important to him, but he also at points recognized that he'd also kind of given up a whole lot. I mean, he didn't at that point realize enough to be nostalgic or recognize that he had missed a big part of life. I mean, he had a tough way to go, and he kind of made it his own way, had to work his way through college, and so he was always kind of one of those people elbowing their way through the crowd and always fighting to move ahead, and I think that even though he was that the main part where he's in Columbus is kind of the launching point of his career, and he was as he was just being launched in his career, starting to realize, I liked it here, and I kind of miss some of this. And so there was that nostalgia. And he's like, at one point, he gets lost in Columbus as he's trying to show this woman around. And, mm-hmm. and it's kind of an example of, how do you get lost in Columbus, really? I mean, it's a grid. And, but he did. And that was part of him kind of realizing that, I like this place. Why am I fighting so hard to get away from it?
He's from
Marion. Yeah, so was John Dean. He went to Stanton Military Academy, and so did John Dean. I was born in Marion, and I went to Stanton Military Academy myself.
Okay.
But I actually looked at those facts. Those are another example of things where it's like I picked them out before I stopped to think about the fact that they both applied to me. Sometimes you just you do those Homer Simpson dolt moments when you're looking at something and realizing that, I want to make this look like it's John Dean, but...
What was the significance of Stanton Military Academy in his life?
It gave him structure, and it also gave him an idea that things operated in a certain way. It also kind of reinforced some of the... I mean, because it had been good for him, he assumed that everything he learned there was good. And that, a lot of his faith in the neocon and, that kind of philosophy came out of that experience as well. And so it was kind of learning that he'd learned some good things there, but maybe not all of them.
What tell me, we've kind of talked around the neocon phrase.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define neoconservatives today? Because they've been around for a long time.
Well, and in different forms.
Right.
They've been around forever. I mean, but probably in the same way that Ron Paul sees them. It's one of those things where you kind of identify with people who, or agree with people. I mean, they're empire builders, as far as I'm concerned. They're not – their motive isn't evil in the sense that they believe that they're making the world and the country safer by a stronger, proactive American foreign policy. Their beliefs are absolutely alien to 90% of the public in this country. So they've got to, most of this country does not want to wage into war in other countries in order to preserve our safety. We have kind of generally most people have the opposite view from various political camps. The neocons, I think they're preoccupied with the role in which the military can play in keeping us safe. And I think that they have kind of broken ranks with a lot of the military historians and basically have embraced the idea of proactive war, of avoiding the problem. I mean, I don't think their motives are evil, and hopefully I got that through in the book that these are people who really believe and they have a passionate belief that we need to take, we need to go to war in Iraq, we need to go to war in Iran, and we need to take steps in North Korea.
Preemptive type.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think the neo part, though, I don't know if I was reading George Will one time, It's people who used to be liberal,
right?
Who they're kind of like reformed smokers,
right?
They're all the more.
they took on. I mean, there is a characteristic on the left of a kind of a social engineering quality. You know, I mean that is
they wanted to fix things that way.
Yeah, and so it's like they took the social engineering, you know, part that appears in the left lots of times, and they brought it over to kind of the militaristic, you know, view of the world, and they you know tied the two things together and have come up with a philosophy that you know is pretty dangerous.
You've been in politics a few decades now.
35 years.
35 yeah. years, yeah. And I was wondering, is it just a lot of talk and a lot of hooey when people say things have gotten worse, things have gotten meaner? Because frankly, you know, I can go back in history,
sure.
and you can read about, you know, the founding quote unquote fathers,
right.
and the mothers for that matter.
Right.
You can't read
right.
about Abigail Adams without hearing about the vitriol that was routinely flung at each other and anonymously
right.
often.
Right. Yeah. You know, that you're exactly right, Anne. I mean, in fact, there are ways in which it's gotten meaner, but not so much in the 35 years I've been involved in politics, and it certainly isn't close to the build up of the Civil War and where the country was at. You know, the yellow journalism period in the late 19th century. And I recently read, you know, Faith of the Founders, which is a fantastic book, but a horrifying look at kind of how religious persecution took hold in this country and how many different religions were persecuted, and how that shaped very, very different views of the founders. And so the negativity that's involved in politics today is not even greater than it was when I first got involved. But what is disconcerting to me is that as great as the internet is, as great as kind of this spreading of information that we have, we have the capacity for from a retail politics end influencing people, and that's where kind of in the final bit of the book where I really kind of focus on hate language and how it can affect people. And when we see a 500% increase in militia membership and hate groups expanding at a very rapid pace in the last couple of years, we can't ignore that. And so I think that and the capacity today with the internet and being able to manipulate hate language and isolate it within groups is something new and is to me that's more frightening than the tone.
Is the proliferation and
the ability to almost organize and create these groups. And, you know, we've seen it in simple things where, you know, people get in the heads of kids who end up, you know, terrorizing their school somehow from things they've learned on the internet. But there's also the organizing that takes place on the internet. And I think the combination of an African-American president, of a lot of the things that we've seen in the way in which he was demonized in the campaign, has led to this gigantic spike in a lot of the hate group stuff. And, you know, that's one of the last points I make in the book. Probably the last chapter in the book, as I looked at the 2008 election, was the labeling Obama as a socialist. That's a very dangerous concept, and it's very wrong, obviously, and something that I wanted to address in the book as well.
That's all the time we have now, Greg.
Went very fast for me.
It went very quickly for me as well. It is a lot of fun to talk about these issues in a conceptual way instead of a newsy, breaking news kind of way. So thanks for joining me today,
Thank
Greg
you very
Haas.
Much, Anne. It was great to be here.
Greg's the author of The Butcher's Thumb, a new political thriller. You can get to it from Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. So check it out there. This is all the time we have today for All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer, helping people make environmentally friendly choices with Meijer EcoWise laundry care, cleaners, paper products, and more. Meijer EcoWise products help lessen the negative impact on our environment because no effort is too small.